All right. Do we have a content warning for this film?
Empty your bladder before the dinner scene.
Welcome to season 6, episode 11 of the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better writer using the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne. Each week, we use a movie, a novel, or a short story to study different storytelling principles so that we can deepen our understanding of story and level up our craft. My name is Valerie Francis, and I'll be leading the discussion today. Here with me are my fellow roundtablers, Kim Kessler, Leslie Watts, and Anne Holly. Before we begin, a quick reminder that Leslie and I have launched Up the Un podcast, where we apply these storytelling principles to the written word. It's available exclusively through our websites. So if that's of interest to you, you can sign up at valeriefrancis.ca/innercircle or writership.com. Also in the Inner Circle, I'll share writing insights that I discover through my own personal study and tools that I develop to help me write my own novels, like the character sheet I've been talking about. So again, if you'd like to join, you can do that at valeriefrancis.ca/innercircle. All right. This week, I am looking at Mrs. Doubtfire in order to study forces of antagonism. This 1993 film was directed by Chris Columbus from a screenplay by Randy Myam Singer and Leslie Dixon. It was based on the 1987 novel Alias Madame Doubtfire by Anne Fine. As always, this is an adult conversation and, you know, you never know, you might hear a few adult words. All right, so the three acts of the story. In the beginning hook, when Daniel Hillard's wife Miranda files for divorce, family court tells him that if he wants joint custody of his kids, he must find a full-time job and create a suitable home in 90 days. Miranda decides to hire a nanny, so Daniel, who's a professional actor, disguises himself as Mrs. Doubtfire and cares for his kids after school. The middle build, Daniel's brother, who just happens to be a makeup artist, creates a full costume, and for the first half of the middle build, Mrs. Doubtfire creates a warm and nurturing environment for Miranda and the children. At the midpoint, the two oldest children discover that Mrs. Doubtfire is actually their father, but they agree to keep his secret. When Mrs. Doubtfire receives an invitation to Miranda's birthday supper, which happens to be the same time and place as Daniel's important business dinner, he must decide whether he'll accept to make his youngest daughter happy or not. He accepts. And finally, in the ending payoff, now a huge part of this ending payoff, I have to say, is taken up by the huge and now iconic 17-minute dinner scene. And this is when Robin Williams is switching back and forth between Daniel and Mrs. Doubtfire multiple times, and eventually his cover's blown. Interestingly, from a storytelling point of view, the ending payoff crisis belongs to Miranda, not to Daniel. When the court awards her full custody and gives Daniel only supervised visitation, she must decide whether to let that ruling stand or do something about it. She decides that Daniel and the children should have more time together, and so he becomes their new babysitter. In terms of genre, I'm calling this globally a performance story with a worldview maturation secondary. Now, there's a whole lot to be said about the genre choice of this film. And it's interesting that Mrs. Doubtfire is dealing with the same subject matter as Kramer versus Kramer, but presenting it in a very different way. Not only is it a different content genre, performance rather than a marriage love story, but it's also a different style genre, a comedy rather than a drama. Now, I don't have time today here to go into a full analysis of genre, but essentially this film is highlighting the importance of the writer's genre choice, and we saw that same thing in Hidden Figures. As writers, we've got all kinds of options to choose from as we select from each of the five leaves on the story grid genre clover. And what we need to do is figure out which combination will serve the stories that we want to tell best.
So interestingly, I don't think this is a global performance story, even though it can technically check all or most of the performance boxes. Rather, I'd say this is a global status story for Daniel. But in this case, success here is about his social status within the hierarchy of the family. He faces misfortune and loses his status in the beginning hook, then fights to regain it in the middle build through his scheme as Mrs. Doubtfire. And it works, you know, until it doesn't. I was fascinated that he doesn't actually change. It's almost like a status admiration character, but he actually fails, so it's more like a status pathetic or a status tragic character. He keeps beating that same drum of his moral code, but he needs to adjust his definition of success and the means by which he attains it in order to actually achieve it. In fact, if it weren't for Miranda's worldview maturation arc about the way that she sees him, the story would actually end negatively, as a cautionary tale. Something like, even well-meaning parents can fail if they don't grow up. This story is another example of why it feels like we need a familial love category rather than just society domestic, because the big meta why of this story is about how familial love can triumph even after divorce. So the performance aspect of the story feels like the vehicle for his attempts to rise, but to me, again, it's not the global story.
As always, Kim, you and I will agree to disagree.
Cheers.
That's one of the great things about StoryGrid, right? Okay, so I chose Mrs. Doubtfire as an example of society as the force of antagonism in a story. My hypothesis is that when society is the villain, it operates through the various characters in the story. Now, this was the case with Brooklyn and with Brokeback Mountain, and it's true of Mrs. Doubtfire. And as Leslie reminded me a few minutes ago, it's also true of Get Out, If Beale Street Could Talk, Selma, and Hidden Figures. Of course, a lot of this film really is a showcase for Robin Williams' talent, but there's also some very fine storytelling happening, starting with the opening scene. It's not the inciting incident of the global story, but it does a fantastic job of introducing the protagonist, the antagonist, and the ordinary world. It sets up everything that's to follow in the rest of the story. We see Daniel's talent for voices and creating characters. We learn his philosophy for what is and is not appropriate for children's programming, and we discover that he's a moral character who chooses his values over money. When society is the force of antagonism, at least in the stories that I've studied so far, the protagonist is expected to behave in ways that are acceptable to the society in which they live. They are to abide by social norms. There's zero tolerance for deviation or for characters to find their own path or to march to the beat of their own drummer. A societal antagonist wants the protagonist to be one of the masses and not their own individual or unique selves. So in the opening scene of Mrs. Doubtfire, the director is the antagonist. He wants Daniel to stick to the script. And this is what societal antagonists want of the protagonist. Just stick to the script. He will tolerate no deviation, no interpretation, no free thinking. As the mouthpiece for the corporate world, he's there to tell Daniel to get in line and do what he's told, or he's out of a job. Do what you're told. Be what society expects a person of your gender and your place in society to be. That's the message of the societal antagonist. We saw this with Brokeback Mountain, where Ennis and Jack are expected to be heterosexual. They're supposed to get married and have families. We saw it in Brooklyn, where Ailish is expected to hunt for a husband and to marry Jim. And we see it here in Mrs. Doubtfire, where Daniel is expected to have a steady and acceptable job and be a responsible parent. And of course, by extension, this means not having any fun and not really enjoying life. It means being more like Miranda. A quick aside here about ins and outs. Again, Stephen Pressfield talks about this on his Writing Wednesdays blog and in his jabs. Just as the beginning and the end of stories mirror one another, the opening scene and the closing scene mirror one another. In the Level Up Your Craft course, Sean goes into detail about how the beginning and the end rhyme, but until Stephen Pressfield pointed it out, I have to admit I never realized how often the opening scene and the closing scene of a story, films, and novels rhyme. Now, this is something I think we all need to start noticing in as we consume stories, whether they're films or television shows or novels, what have you, because it really helps set up a satisfying resolution to a story. The opening scene of Mrs. Doubtfire is when Daniel is working on a children's cartoon and taking umbrage at the content. He's told by the socially acceptable adults of society that he's not responsible to look after his own children. The irony, of course, is that he's completely responsible. He's the one who points out that it's irresponsible to create programming that promotes smoking to minors. In the closing scene, Daniel is once again working on a children's show. However, because he has now learned to integrate the Mrs. Doubtfire aspects of his personality, and he's grown up a little bit, he's not simply an employee of a show, he's the star of the show. And what's more, the show reflects his values and what he feels is appropriate for children. Now, of course, it still allows him to be playful. Now, the director in that opening scene isn't the only antagonist in the story. Society has a very strict set of rules that dictate how a man of Daniel's age and how a father should behave and what he should do. So at every turn, Daniel is confronted by another character who represents one of these rules. And all of the rules are opposite to Daniel's nature. And what's even more impressive is that every character is introduced in the beginning hook. His next door neighbor and the police react to the party because the noise, the animals, and the general energy level are all socially unacceptable. Miranda is an obvious antagonist because she's the one who files for divorce due to his lack of seriousness and irresponsibility. She argues with him, drops the kids off late and picks them up early, and refuses to let Daniel pick up the children from school and watch them in the afternoons. She's the one who brings out Daniel's shadow, causing him to express his shadow desire that she come down with piles or amoebic dysentery, which is a really funny scene, and in fact, causing him to invent Mrs. Doubtfire. Family court recognizes that he's obviously a loving father, but judges that love isn't enough. Daniel must have a steady job and acceptable home, and he's given 90 days to conform to what society deems acceptable. The court liaison expresses an open dislike of Daniel's talents and overall attitude. He's trying to keep things light because that's how he can cope with the seriousness of what's happening to him. But she interprets it as irresponsibility or flippancy. The court liaison, like society, does not tolerate free spirits. Free spirits must be brought to task or punished. And Daniel is punished with his new job, where in the opening scene we saw him as an actor, acting. Now he's packing up films and shipping them for a television studio. He has a new boss who has no sense of humor, no talent, no dreams or aspirations. He does what he's told without question, and for that, he's rewarded by being the boss in his little corner of the world. Society forces Daniel to be his underling. Now, none of these characters that we've met have a sense of humor because the antagonist is in contrast to the protagonist, Daniel, who is defined by his humor. Now, society isn't finished with Daniel yet, though. It antagonizes him through his eldest daughter, Lydia, who chastises him for not trying hard enough, and it introduces Stuart, who does everything society has expected of him and who is being richly rewarded. He is fit, handsome, rich, admired, respected, and he's taking Daniel's family away from him. Another quick side note here. I find it really interesting that within the family dynamic, the hero, victim, and villain roles are really well defined throughout the story. Daniel, as our protagonist, is the hero. The children are the victims, and Miranda is the villain. What's particularly interesting about this is that while the roles are crystal clear, the subject matter is anything but black and white. The forces of antagonism that were introduced in the beginning hook then carry through the middle build, but more are added. As a woman, Daniel has to deal with the bus driver and with fashion, because society dictates that women wear heels, right? He also has to deal with a society's attitude toward a man dressing in women's clothing or disguising himself for any reason. Miranda and family court have a very strong reaction to it, but even his son questions it. So that means that two of Daniel's three children are mouthpieces for the societal force of antagonism. So, I think Mrs. Doubtfire does an incredible job of creating a societal force of antagonism that opposes the protagonist at every single turn. Okay, that's enough from me. Kim, I know this season you're looking at the beginning hooks of stories. What did you come up with for Mrs. Doubtfire?
Yes, so I'm going to be looking at establishing plausibility in your beginning. So I have to say, this was such a fun pick this week. This story is a classic from when I was a kid, and I've seen it countless times, but it was great to rewatch it now with fresh eyes again on so many levels. One strange surprise was to recognize how much this story may have influenced my own storytelling, both in the high contrast of comedy and drama, and also the protagonist's ability to disguise themselves via movie makeup. It turns out that my novel is a conglomerate of How I Met Your Mother, A Spell for Chameleon, and Mrs. Doubtfire. Go figure. The lens of self-discovery is never far away when you're studying story. Okay, so this week I'm excited to point out a crucial aspect of beginnings that I think that Mrs. Doubtfire does extremely well, and that is establishing plausibility. So let's unpack what I mean by that. In order for a reader to immerse in your story, things need to make sense. This doesn't mean that they have to know everything or even understand everything that they do know, but it means that you have to build the case that what happens in your story is plausible. It's possible, likely, and it makes quote-unquote sense in context of the situation. We have to believe you. Now, some readers are never going to be able to make that leap because certain types of suspension of disbelief are just not their bag, and that's okay. Your job is not to convince everyone, but certainly to convince your target reader. This is all the more reason why you must know your genre conventions and what your target reader will expect, accept, or not. So let me show you what I mean. Here's how the filmmakers create plausibility in Mrs. Doubtfire. So as Valerie mentioned in the opening scene, we witness Daniel Hillard, a la Robin Williams, voicing multiple characters through multiple emotional states of a cartoon. He's very talented and convincing. We also witness his personal character in action when he argues about the morality of presenting smoking as cool in a kids' show, to the point where he quits over it. Next, we see him then pick up his kids from school, doing more fun voices, and generally being an all-around fun and present father. After the global inciting incident, in which Miranda comes home to find the house, now a barnyard, and states she wants a divorce, we see Daniel staying at his brother Frank's house. Frank and his partner Jack are professional movie makeup artists. Now, this scene is interesting because in terms of plot, it doesn't really do a whole lot. It doesn't really move the story forward per se, but it's vital as a setup scene for later. The information that we need is naturally woven into the scene. So in the scene, Frank is on the phone with their mother. Jack is working on a latex mask in their home studio, and Mom on the phone asks about some beige concealer. And when Frank wants to get off the phone, he uses their work as an excuse that they're needed on set. You know, they have places to go and faces to paint. So this establishes their profession and their skill level. We also hear Daniel's statements of denial about his marriage ending, stating his marriage is only on hiatus and this is just a temporary thing. I know, Miranda, it's going to blow over. Then cut to the classic courtroom scene where the divorce is being finalized. We get another scene when Daniel is meeting at the social worker's office, and he demonstrates his vocal talents, again, in classic Robin Williams montage style. Then, when the inciting incident of the middle build occurs, Daniel sees an opportunity to spend more time with his kids by playing the after-school nanny. We are bought in. In fact, the way they bring us through this is bit by bit. At first, when he changes the phone number on the newspaper ad and makes all the prank calls to Miranda, we think maybe he's just trying to get her to give up the idea of a babysitter and let him do it instead. But then, when he is actually charming and convincing enough to get an interview, we realize his plan. This is definitely the kickoff to the fun and games section of the middle build. Also, the way the makeover montage at Frank and Jack's house also builds bit by bit towards the full-on bodysuit, opaque tights, face mask, wig, and teeth covers of Mrs. Doubtfire. Through all of this, we are further convinced. My point here is that these middle build scenes work at their best because they were set up in the beginning hook, creating plausibility and credibility for Daniel's scheme. Now, the flip side of this is a story that shows a character taking an extreme action but hasn't set up or even hinted at it in the beginning. My husband recently watched the film The Foreigner, which stars Jackie Chan as quite a serious character, which is a departure from his standard comedic roles, but we both thought he did a great job. And funnily enough, Pierce Brosnan, who plays Miranda's new boyfriend in Mrs. Doubtfire. Now, this story couldn't be more different from Mrs. Doubtfire, but this principle about setting up plausibility to keep the audience engaged is absolutely in play. On Wikipedia, it describes Chan's character, Quan, as a former Vietnam War Special Operations Forces soldier who runs a Chinese restaurant in London. When his teenage daughter is killed in a bombing claimed by a group calling itself the Authentic IRA, Quan seeks out the names of the bombers, first from Scotland Yard and then from the Northern Ireland Deputy First Minister, Liam Hennessy, which is played by Brosnan. When Quan is unable to get these answers, he travels to Belfast to speak to Hennessy in person, who again claims to have no knowledge of the bombers, and again, Quan doesn't believe him. Then, Quan immediately goes to the bathroom and assembles a homemade bomb out of lemonade, string, matches, and a cigarette, and sets it off, a warning that more to come if he doesn't get the names. Now, this takes place during that opening sequence of the middle build, similar to Daniel Hillard's transformation in Mrs. Doubtfire. And while the Wikipedia page tells us that Quan is a formal Special Forces soldier, nothing in the film has given us any indication that Quan has these skills, only that he suffered tragic loss. It isn't until the midpoint that Quan's background comes to light, to the audience or to the other characters. So why do I bring all this up? I have seen this occur in many of my clients' manuscripts, where they withhold certain information from the reader, sometimes knowingly and sometimes not, creating mystery when that is not the most effective way to tell their story, especially when using deep point of view for their character, where the reader wants to experience empathy for the protagonist. This is part of the problem in The Foreigner. They are deploying deep and empathetic point of view for Quan, but then withholding information and creating mystery, which just doesn't fit well with the point of view that they've chosen. On the other hand, this does not mean you have to give the reader everything up front, and certainly not an entire backstory dump on page one, but it's about intentionally delivering key pieces of information at helpful times in a helpful order to create the most effective and satisfying experience for your target audience, the core emotion. So, after a season of flailing around in the dark about beginnings, some things are coming to light. Not the least of which is that the beginning can only be truly crafted when you know your end goal, core emotion and core event and final core value. Knowing where you want your protagonist and your reader to end up enables you to line up the right dominoes in the right order, in the right direction from the outset. To say it another way, the reader needs breadcrumbs to build credibility. Show us what we need to see to allow your story to be possible. So while all of this is part of your means of turning the plot conventions, it's also a convention of your reality genre. Now remember, reality is one of genre's five-leaf clovers. It can be factual, meaning it's based on actual events. Realism means that it follows the rules of our known reality. Fantasy means it follows the rules of some other reality. And absurdism means there are no rules. Whichever reality your story is, you want to clue in your reader clearly. If your story takes place in a fantasy reality, establish the rules that differ from our known reality as early as you can. Animals can talk, ghosts are present, ships can travel faster than light, etc. And based on how the characters react to this, you show us what that means. This is normal, this is out of the ordinary, this is scary, etc. And within the reality of realism, like Mrs. Doubtfire and The Foreigner, both of which are technically possible, you have to introduce the elements to the reader so they believe the story is not simply possible, but plausible, and not only plausible, but credible.
That's awesome, Kim. Thank you so much. And you're looking at Objects of Desire this week. I'm curious, what did you find out?
Well, I want to just start by reading something that I think a lot of us are familiar with. This is an alternate description of The Wizard of Oz. Leslie has cited this on an earlier episode. Transported to a surreal landscape, a young girl kills the first person she meets and then teams up with three strangers to kill again. And the reason I bring this up is that I'm going to be reading Mrs. Doubtfire a little bit like the person who read The Wizard of Oz, totally the wrong way, missing the big meta why and so forth. This movie did not contain a big meta why that I resonated with at all. So, I've decided to look at Objects of Desire in today's film because I'm finishing up my story grid beat on that subject, and I'm interested in how to establish a character's wants and needs from the very beginning. First, let me just stipulate that a 1990s comedy designed around Robin Williams doesn't have to work according to story grid principles in order to be loved and remembered fondly. It just has to be fast-paced and funny with lots of Robin Williams and a satisfying ending. Whether this is a good story from story grid principles is a little harder for me to say, but it did do a great job of establishing Objects of Desire in the opening scenes. Problems began in the middle build, and by the end, my Objects of Desire analysis kind of failed. So I'm just going to focus on the opening scenes. First of all, what do we mean by Objects of Desire? Quick refresher, it means wants and needs, principally with the protagonist, but also you need to consider them for the antagonist. The character has a conscious want that they are living out at the beginning of the story, and the inciting incident either sparks a new desire, which they set out to obtain, or threatens the status quo, which the character will fight to keep. Mrs. Doubtfire clearly falls into the latter case. The whole story, as I see it, is Daniel Hillard going to ridiculous lengths to keep his relationship with his kids as unchanged as he possibly can. So that's the want. What about the need? As obstacles mount in any good story, the character needs to make some kind of internal change in order to finally get the thing they wanted, usually in some altered form. StoryGrid refers to this internal change as the subconscious need. So there you are, wants and needs, objects of desire. The conscious want will ideally drive the character through to the global crisis, at which point they have to uncover and embrace that need, which usually involves some redefinition of the want they started out with. Something internal has to give, or else the character will wind up with nothing. This means that through the beginning hook and the middle build, the protagonist will make choices based on the want, while gradually dealing with complications that make it harder and harder for them to ignore the real need. The global crisis should force them to choose between the want and the need, and in a prescriptive story, they will discover the needed quality within, make the needed change, and succeed, while in a cautionary story, they can't make the change and they fail. Mrs. Doubtfire establishes some clear wants and needs in the opening scenes. They aren't explicit, nor do they need to be, but they are clearly demonstrated or shown through choices and actions on the two main characters' parts. I'm identifying these as Daniel and Miranda, the husband and wife. I want to focus particularly on the kinds of things that aren't purely dependent on cinematic elements, notably, in this case, Robin Williams' unique acting abilities. So what do we see and hear right up front in this movie that could equally well be conveyed by a writer in text alone? We open on Daniel, as has been established. He's a voice actor. He's doing his job amazingly well and apparently having a wonderful time. And then he goes off script. When the director stops him, Daniel protests the content of a cartoon he's doing all the voices for. And the cartoon character is smoking a cigarette, and Daniel wants no part of that, as everyone's already talked about. He not only quits over it, but this is important. He tells the director to piss off as he's doing his flounce out the door. Now, in this scene, Daniel is wearing an unbuttoned plaid shirt over a white t-shirt. He's pretty unkempt looking. He has a haircut that, at best, we could say needs a bit of work, and at worst, isn't really all that different from the one we were about to see on his 12-year-old son. These details are the sort of things you can easily describe in writing. Now, since Daniel's now unemployed, he surprises his kids by picking them up after school in his junky 20-year-old station wagon. I actually looked it up to see how old it was at the time of the movie. His kids adore him, but they know him. They instantly figure out, Lydia particularly figures out, that he's there because he's lost his job. Clearly, this has happened before. But no problem. Even though Mom has said no birthday party for Chris, whose 12th birthday it is, Mom's not going to be home, Daniel says very gleefully. He's got a huge party already planned. It's a way too childish a party for a 12-year-old boy. It's got a traveling petting zoo and balloons. But everyone is having a wonderful time anyway until Mom actually does get home. So these are Daniel's opening scenes. Quitting his job voicing cartoons, flouncing off with a rude remark to the boss, picking up his kids and throwing a children's party that makes so much noise that the neighbor calls both Mom and the cops. We learn a lot about Daniel's wants from these clues, and we can guess some things about what he's going to have to realize that he needs. First, Daniel does value his ethical stand, but he values it more than he values his job, and it's clearly a job he loves and is good at. He cares, in short, more about having fun with his children than actually providing for them. He clearly wants to be with his children, but we have the impression after three scenes that that's because he wants to be a child himself. He's a Toys R Us kid. He doesn't want to grow up. His clothes, his hair, his general presentation all declare him not to be a serious adult. I even note that, perhaps coincidentally, his name, Daniel, is an anagram for denial. The want and need are generally dictated by the genre. And there's some confusion about what the genre is here. I think I agree with Kim that Daniel does have a status arc, but his want and need, as shown in these opening scenes, are so much more like those of a worldview maturation character that I'm not 100% sure. Next, for contrast, we get a scene with Miranda, Daniel's wife. She's professionally dressed, not a hair out of place. She's in a fancy office environment, directing subordinates. Now, she's pleasant, but she clearly wants order, as contrasted with Daniel's desire for chaos and fun. When an old love interest calls, we also see that maybe she wants romance. maybe she's tired of being a mom to three kids and a husband. This is all before the inciting incident, which is when Miranda tells Daniel that she wants a divorce. Now, we've been set up so far to expect Daniel to move towards his need to grow up and maybe find some compromise between his love of fun and his responsibility to be a parent and not just a pal to his children. And we expect Miranda to lighten up at least a little bit. And all of that does happen by the end, more or less. Not every scene in a story has to force the character to make some choice directly related to the want or the need. The 15 or 20 core scenes must do that, but all other scenes are free to turn on other values. But the crisis choice in every scene has to have something to do with what the character wants or needs, however indirectly. And this brings us to the concept of essential action. Whatever the character is literally doing or deciding in a given scene, their underlying motivation should still be related to the global want or need. So, for instance, when the director in the opening scene offers the ultimatum to stick to the script or quit, on the surface, Daniel quits for ethical reasons. That's what he says. But what's really driving his choice to quit, I think, is that some weary grown-up has put the brakes on his exuberance and the job has just stopped being fun and Daniel just wants to have fun. Well, the fun ends in divorce court when the judge gives Daniel only one day a week visitation with his kids and orders him to shape up by getting an apartment and a job. The judge is telling him in words exactly what he needs. But even as Daniel is putting his few possessions into his junky car and saying goodbye to his kids, he makes fun of the kid's grandmother, who is standing right there. His literal action is moving out as ordered, but his essential action is still to thumb his nose at convention and co-opt his children as pals or friends. We even see him fail to stop at the stop sign as he's driving away. He just can't be bothered with rules. By the way, we see him fail to stop at that same stop sign at the end of the film, indicating that he's still not really bound by the rules, though he has changed. Now, this same essential action repeats over and over again through the middle build. He says he wants to be with his kids, and he truly does go to ridiculous extremes to make that happen. But at the same time, he continues to try to sabotage Miranda's new life. He makes fun of Stu, gives Miranda terrible relationship advice in exactly the ways that a child of divorce will sometimes do to one or other of the parents, trying to stop them from breaking up. I don't think the global crisis is very good storytelling here. It exists solely to let Robin Williams be Robin Williams, and that's great. It's funny. It's ridiculous. And of course, his big charade falls apart. But the crisis choice is weak. Valerie's already pointed this out. Should he be a grown-up and take the business meeting that promises him a new career that would help him support these kids he loves so much? Or should he attend a dinner as Mrs. Doubtfire so he can continue to sabotage the new relationship? This is my evil Wizard of Oz interpretation. Well, he decides, why not both? His motivation seems to be that it's fun to keep fooling everyone, maybe entertain the two older kids who already know his secret anyway. It's not clear at that point why he's continuing the charade at all. Very quickly after Daniel takes on the Mrs. Doubtfire persona in the beginning of the middle build, his wants and needs from scene to scene become less clear. But during the beginning hook, this film does use clear, literal, and essential action, that is, character choices and the motivation for making them, to show us both Daniel's and Miranda's wants and needs, and eventually it does deliver on them. So it might be worth studying for that reason, though I would be remiss, a side note here, if I didn't tell you that this film's take on gender identity and sexuality has not aged well at all. So it's not a film I would generally recommend for that reason alone.
I can't disagree with you on some of the points you've made, Anne, but the teeth falling in the wine glass still cracks me up.
It's still pretty funny, yeah.
Okay, Leslie, this season you are doing a deep dive into point of view and narrative device. What have you got for us this week?
Yes, I'm focusing on point of view and narrative device this season. And here's my quick description. If a genre is what your story is about, point of view and narrative device are how you deliver that story to the reader, or, as is the case today, the viewer. Point of view is a technical element which tells us whether it's first person or third person, for example. And there is some overlap between point of view and narrative device, but basically the narrative device or situation is the content element of your story's delivery to the reader. And it answers the questions, who or what is the source of the story? When and where is that source located in relation to the events and characters of the story? Who is the story for and why is it being told? Point of view and narrative device give writers useful constraints for making content and technical decisions from macro to micro, not at random or on a whim, but for solid story-based reasons. Now, I've been on a multi-year quest to understand how point of view and narrative device work and how to choose the best one for your story. I explore this in my upcoming Story Grid Beat on point of view, as well as in my bite-sized episode on choosing your point of view. I'll include links to that episode and my point of view articles in the show notes. Now, I start my inquiry with the narrative problem presented by the premise because it gives me immediate constraints for my analysis. Generally speaking, the premise is a character in a particular setting with a problem. In Mrs. Doubtfire, Daniel is a father and voice actor in San Francisco who will lose custody of his kids if he can't provide a suitable environment and find employment within 3 months. Now, whether you see this as a performance or a status or a worldview global story, you've got some serious moving parts here. The conventions of these genres require showing different levels of society and/or a big social problem. This often means including lots of characters to embody different perspectives on the problem from multiple layers of society. Now, this is not part of the premise per se, but the element of comedy is worth mentioning here. Full disclosure, I'm not as familiar with the comedic style as I am with the dramatic. But what seems relevant is that for these purposes, comedy is a way of highlighting a problem by making light of it and not facing it directly, but coming at it sideways. The filmmakers had the additional challenge, which may have been part of their primary intent, to showcase Robin Williams' considerable talents. Now, that means some slapstick action, and that's inconsistent with a more intimate point of view. So, with all of that in mind, let's consider the point of view. I would characterize the film's point of view by what literary critic Norman Friedman calls the dramatic mode. Orson Scott Card calls this third-person limited cinematic, and I've also seen it called third-person objective and described as being the rough equivalent of the street view of Google Earth. This is a third-person narration with no access to any of the characters' internal experience. And there's no explicit commentary from the narrator either. Though I should say, we can often tell what an unseen narrator thinks about a situation through the details that are included and those that are left out. Now, in this point of view, we see characters acting and we hear them talking, but we have to guess at what they might be thinking or feeling from the external clues. Friedman calls this a stage play cast into the typographical mode. I feel pretty certain this was not the point of view of the middle grade novel on which the film is based, though I couldn't get a copy of it to check. This point of view is rarely used in fiction. Sometimes you'll see it in part of a story that employs other points of view. Now, if you're interested in writing from this narrative vantage point, Hills Like White Elephants by Ernest Hemingway is the closest I've seen. It's one of Friedman's examples, actually, and though the opening paragraph feels like a neutral, omniscient narrator to me. So that's the point of view. What's the narrative device? Mrs. Doubtfire is a typical Hollywood film, which I'm finding means the narrative device is a little more difficult to suss out than in a novel. We have various camera shots and angles that provide the vantage point for our view, and that gives us some clues, but it doesn't give up the more subjective elements so easily. When this happens, my conclusion about narrative device is a guess based on my reading of the filmmaker's intent. Reasonable minds could certainly differ on this point, so if you do disagree, you're not necessarily wrong. I think it's useful to consider this even though we're guessing, because point of view and narrative device are all about which collection of writing techniques will produce the experience and effect you want in your story. So thinking about the effect or the experience, we can consider what the intent might have been. So in terms of the experience or the effect, I boil that down to the controlling idea. And here I would describe the controlling idea or theme this way. Divorced parents find success in spite of their choices when they remember in time that it's really about the kids. If I think about who might want to deliver a message like this, I immediately think of kids in a family experiencing divorce. The kids in that situation might want to remind the parents getting divorced that though they have their differences, the kids still need them to show up as adults and put them first. A secondary audience might be kids of a divorce to let them know that the divorce isn't their fault. Now, in what form might we see a narration like this? I actually see it as a play staged by kids for their parents' benefit, though that might be some of the influence of the film. So assuming I am right about the point of view and narrative device here, how well does it work? In other words, how well do the point of view and narrative device of Mrs. Doubtfire solve the narrative problems presented by the premise? I'd say pretty well, especially if I'm right about the controlling idea and the intention for the story. The distant point of view is well suited to the comedic style and the large cast of characters required to present different aspects of the problem. And I suspect that the style here, the comedic style, is a function of the narrative device. If kids are telling this story, they might want loads of humor, including fart jokes and slapstick gags, to get their parents laughing. The birthday party in the beginning hook may not be every kid's dream, but I bet few would turn it down. So that's further evidence that that might be the vibe that the filmmakers are going for. Now, even if the kids telling a story like this are all grown up, they might want to employ this type of comedy to come at the issue sideways and offer a spoonful of sugar with the message to their parents that it's time for them to grow up.
Thank you so much, Leslie. I'm learning so much from your work on point of view and narrative device. Okay, to end off each episode, we like to finish with a few final thoughts and takeaways. To kick things off, let's hear from Kim.
Setups are so important. Introducing elements of your reality genre early, even if it's set in the modern world, will help your reader build trust and suspend their disbelief. If you don't, and you introduce new key information too late, it will feel like a cheat. Keep readers engaged by building a case for credibility for the most banal to the most fantastical circumstances.
My takeaway this week is that a lot of my clients struggle with where to start their story. And Kim was just alluding to this too. One thing Mrs. Doubtfire does well is deliver opening scenes that demonstrate the character's objects of desire. This is critical information that the reader or viewer needs right up front, and all good opening scenes are opportunities to deliver it. So one great way to decide which of your many potential starting points to use is to ask yourself, which beginning has the greatest potential to show my protagonist's conscious desire and hint at the change they're eventually going to have to embrace, and then use that one.
We read deeply within our genre so that we understand reader expectations, and we read widely outside our genre to help us innovate and look for examples of other elements of storytelling. But we can also look outside our medium for inspiration and guidance. Obviously, on the podcast, we've used films as models of global storytelling, but they're useful to us for other aspects of storytelling as well. Novelists have certain tasks in common with filmmakers, and we can look at the differences to see how we might translate them in our medium. With any story you observe, consider, what can I learn from this example that I can use to level up my storytelling?
And for me, the biggest takeaway this week is that when we're crafting stories with society as the main force of antagonism, we've got to think carefully about our cast design. What characters do we need to express the different societal attitudes, and how do they antagonize the main character? To wind up the episode, we take questions from our listeners. This week's question comes to us from Sue Copil. Sue, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right. She's in the StoryGrid community forum. Sue writes, I would love to hear an episode on how you use the StoryGrid to critique a chapter or short story that is not working. How do you spot the trouble problems? Tips for coming up with solutions, and advice that critique groups might use. Thanks so much. Love the podcast. Anne, you want to take this one?
I have a story to tell about this one. I was in a critique group back when I first encountered StoryGrid, and it was a solid group with strict standards where you submitted a scene and weren't allowed to speak while the others were telling you about your missing comma or your faulty word choice or the feeling they had that this character didn't quite seem plausible. One day in I come with the Five Commandments and totally disrupt the status quo. I don't deliver a single line or copy edit on anybody's submission that week. I say, look, your complications aren't progressing. And look, nothing's changing in this scene. They're just sitting there eating dinner. I busted up the silence rule and asked the writer to explain what they were going for. I insisted on being allowed to do the same when it was my turn. The light began to dawn, and even though they hated it, my fellow critique group partners, they had to admit that what I was catching in the net of the StoryGrid Five Commandments was useful stuff that made their stories better. Well, I quit that group. I joined another one that I also tried to disrupt with StoryGrid, and finally I created my own. Almost 4 years later, that one is still going strong. We do not call it a critique group. We call it an editing group. We started it based on StoryGrid, and we read each other's scenes with the specific goal of finding the Five Commandments, making sure the complications progress, pointing out where there's no clear turning point or when the scene turns, but not on any value that's relevant to the global story. We know each other's global story because we talk freely about that. We know each other's genres. We all study masterworks to help form our stories, and we tend to study each other's masterworks to help each other. As to how you use StoryGrid to analyze your own scenes alone, I'm still not very good at that. It's why an editing partner or editing group is so valuable. The work we do in the StoryGrid Level Up Your Craft and Ground Your Craft courses is all about scene analysis. It's absolutely foundational to writing and revising a story that works, but it's really hard to get enough distance on your own scenes to apply it. I use the StoryGrid spreadsheet questions to take a stab at it, but my editing group partners are much better at finding problems in my scenes than I am. So since you're in the guild, Sue, use the guild forum, the community forum, to seek out an editing partner who has the same StoryGrid baseline as you do. Now, for listeners who are not in the guild, do what I did. Disrupt an existing group with the Five Commandments and demonstrate to others how valuable they are. And then get those others to buy in and do the same thing for you. And if that doesn't work, just start your own group.
Start your own StoryGrid editing group.
Absolutely. That's the only way to fly.
If you have a question about forces of antagonism or any other story principle, you can ask it on Twitter at StoryGridRT, or better still, by going to storygrid.com/resources, clicking on Editor Roundtable Podcast, and leaving us a voice message. Alrighty, that wraps it up for this week. Great discussion, everybody. Thank you so much, Anne, Leslie, and Kim, for your excellent editorial insights into Mrs. Doubtfire. We hope our discussion has given you a better grasp of how to think about incorporating forces of antagonism into your own stories. You can find links and additional material in the show notes at storygrid.com. If you want to connect with one of us directly, links to our websites can be found in the show notes. And a reminder that if you want to hear Up, the Unpodcast, or access any of the other writing tips and tools I come up with, join my inner circle at valeriefrancis.ca/innercircle. To support the show, leave us a rating and review and tell your writer friends about us. Join us next time when Anne will look at short story structure in A Private Experience. Why not give it a read during the week and follow along with us? Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.